remember where we are. We're in the structure part of things, and I've just told you a little bit about what ordinary New Yorkers thought at the time. Let me tell you just very quickly about what the naturalists thought. I mean, I've alluded to that. There's this enormous transformation going on in the period that we're discussing. For historians of science, this period is extremely juicy for natural history. And the reason is that what's really happening in the first 20 years of the 19th century is that an entirely new basis for organizing nature is in the ascendant. And that is called comparative anatomy. And it's primarily linked to the Museum of Natural History in Paris. And it's especially associated with the name of Georges Cuvier, which probably won't mean much to many of you here, but a figure of considerable importance in the history of science. What's comparative anatomy? I've gestured at this already. For someone like Linnaeus's name you probably know. He's famous for being a kind of taxonomic genius who organized the natural world. Linnaeus's system for organizing botany, plants, was especially effective because it worked on external characteristics of the plant. You got a flower. You counted the pistils and the stamens, right? And then you basically looked on a chart and you found the number of pistils, the number of stamens, and that gave you the class of the plant you were looking at. This was terrific for explorers. We mentioned that I have an interest in natural history explorers, because why? You don't need to carry a bunch of annoying books. You don't need to know tons and tons of Latin. You don't have to carry a dissecting kit or a microscope. All you have to do is pick a flower and go 1, 2, 3, pull out your handy dandy chart, whack, you know where you are, and you can give the thing a name, more or less. For animals, external characteristics don't work quite so well. It's not so tidy. But basically, most of the systems for organizing the natural world used by scientists before the late 18th century, early 19th century, used external characteristics, like quadruped, 4 feet. It's the same kind of thing as the flowers. You look at it, you're like 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, we know that that's a quadruped. And you can do the same thing with insects, base it on numbers of feet. And then there were other systems that used numbers of teeth and number of fingernails and number of hoof parts and these kinds of things. But what you were doing was trying to get a system that you could identify pretty easily from external characteristics. Comparative anatomy moves into the inside of the animals. And this is Mitchell, who's going to be the great proselytizer for comparative anatomy in the early Republic. Samuel Mitchell was so keen. I mean, he was really something of a nut, a kind of Jeffersonian spirit who was enormously concerned with popular uplift at the same time. He'd studied in Edinburgh. He'd spent time in France. So he had kind of a polish of continental learning. He used to go around, these were the days, and print up broadsheets exhorting New Yorkers, this was before the trial, exhorting New Yorkers to learn more taxonomy and systematics. Every New Yorker ought to be sort of, you know, in there swinging and learning the way animals work. So he says here, this was the kind of thing he would like tack up on a street corner. Anatomy is the basis of improved zoology. The classification of animals is founded upon their organization. This can be ascertained only by dissection. The use of the knife is recommended for the purpose of acquiring an acquaintance with the structure of animals. And I'm here paraphrasing a section that I've had to cut. Thus, basically, all citizens ought to avail themselves of all opportunities to cultivate comparative anatomy and to communicate the results of their labors and researches to the society. So this is a guy who had a mission. And, you know, when suddenly Whale's Fish was at issue at the court next door, he really wanted to make a splash so that New Yorkers would hear about how important it was for them to learn the new systematics, and specifically to learn how to do comparative anatomy, internal anatomy. So lungs, respiratory systems, reproductive systems, nervous systems, and so forth. So to give you some sense of Mitchell's testimony on the stand, Mitchell says, "As a man of science, I can say positively that a whale is no more a fish than a man. Nobody pretends to the contrary nowadays but lawyers and politicians." So he gave him hell, and he meant this. And how did he mean it? Well, we gestured at that already. A man is a mammal just like a whale is a mammal. So the answer is whales and human beings are equally non-fish from a taxonomic perspective. And you can imagine how this went over in the courtroom, right? I mean, you had a fisherman up there who was called as the next witness who says, you know, I thought I was a man because I lived out of the water just as much as I thought a whale was a fish because it lived in the water. And, you know, this stuff is crazy what people are saying in here today. I don't buy it. And here I'll just, you know, touch on some of the sort of deeper, juicier historical issues that are at stake in the trial. So this is the lawyers for Maurice cross-examining Mitchell, reminding the jury of what's at stake if they roll with the philosophers and the scientists on this. So, members of the jury, you know, we have a statute which declares that every free man in the state of New York shall be entitled to a vote at our public elections. Let us suppose, then, that at some one of these arduous struggles where everything in the shape of a man has been, by the zeal of the politicians, urged to the hustings, that the learned doctor had appeared, leading forward with all due gravity to the polls an orangutan, or a man of the woods. Would the stranger's vote be received, although the doctor should very learnedly and eloquently urge his claims, as he has done those of the whale on the present occasion? He breathes the vital air, the doctor might say, through lungs. He moves erect and has warm blood. The female brings forth her young alive and rears the bantling at her breasts. The inspectors would say, in reply to all the eloquence and learning of the doctor, as we do in the case of the whale, all this is indeed very strange and curious. But still, doctor, it is a monkey, in common acceptation, however naturalists may choose to hail and class him as a brother. Now, this is kind of funny, but I expect some of you kind of have goosebumps in the audience here, because this is like, I mean, it gets my skin up, because it is funny, but of course, you're hearing, if you know anything about race in the 19th century, a pretty clear citation of the motto of the abolitionist societies, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And you feel pretty clearly an evocation of the question of race, which, for those of you who are real New York historians, even I know enough to know that with the passage of the Emancipation Act of 1817, just a year before this, the question of the free black franchise had become enormously contentious, indeed violent, in New York. And we have the recent New York Historical Society exhibit on slavery in New York to remind us of just how contentious these issues were in this area. So there had been considerable violence in the previous election as efforts had been made to suppress free black vote. There were about 300 free black voters in the city of New York at the time whose votes were thought to be potentially decisive in the closely contested election of 1816. So what's really going on here is the lawyers are reminding you that if you let scientific expertise into civic life and you give them the keys to defining categories, just be advised they are going to take those keys and use those keys to open boxes and sort human beings, and you may or may not like what it is that they do. And so these were issues explicitly raised and wrestled through over the course of the trial. So ordinary New Yorkers, the men of learning, and I'll just say quickly, lest any of my history of science colleagues catch me, I've used the term scientist several times in connection with Mitchell and others in this period, but that is what we serious historians, join me here, call an anachronism. The term scientist does not exist in English until 1840. It's coined by William Whewell, Englishman, master of Trinity College. And it's interesting. The word has an interesting history because he coined it explicitly to echo the term artist. He wanted there to be a kind of category for people of learning about nature that had a bit the sound to it and the dignity of a term like artist. So careful historians of science do not use the term scientist for anybody before the late 1830s, so we call them natural philosophers, men of learning, these kinds of things. Men of science, you can say that. So if I use those strange circumlocutions, you'll now know why I'm doing that. It's to be faithful to our historical sources. So let's do our third category. The fishermen and whalers, those who fish and whale, what did these folks know about these animals? Well, in one sense, they knew a heck of a lot more than the philosophers. Mitchell had never really been anywhere near a whale. though he had all kinds of ideas about where they belonged in the order of things. Whereas, as you probably know, in Sag Harbor and in Nantucket and in New Bedford, there were tons of folks who had gone eye to eye with the great whales on the high seas, in the Pacific, in the Atlantic, Indian Ocean, etc. Whaling was just at this time coming to be an industry in which the United States possessed a kind of global dominance. By the 1850s, there are 700 American whaling vessels in the Pacific, more than 150 of those vessels in Hawaii at any given day. Think about that for kind of American global presence much earlier than we often imagine. What did these guys think whales were? What did they think? Where did they think they belonged in the order of things? Here I'm interested in a kind of lay expertise. I mean, when you talk about ordinary New Yorkers, you're talking about vernacular knowledge, not experts. When you talk about men of learning, you talk about scientific expertise. When you talk about lay expertise, you're talking about a specialized community that has a lot of detailed knowledge, but it's just not the particular kind of elite culture knowledge that we associate with scientific institutions. This kind of research, for the real archival types, this is dirty fingers kind of stuff. I spent months and months reading logbooks of whaling vessels to here and there glean a clue as to what these folks thought about anatomy and physiology. And the word on the street when I read the secondary literature was that whalemen all knew that whales weren't fish, and that basically whalemen weren't very interested in natural history. And you can imagine that my book really tries to contest both those claims. In the end, it's pretty clear that whalemen all thought that whales were fish. The two whalers that give testimony in this trial offer conflicting evidence. There's a captain who says, well, I read the encyclopedia, and I know that they are not fish. And then there's an ordinary whaleman who says, you know, we always called them fish, and it's news to me that they're not fish. So I depart in this chapter from that conflicting testimony and read my way through these interesting sources. And I'll just show you some great images. That was part of the fun of finding this stuff. This is a diagram I found in one of the whaling logbooks. It's an interesting diagram. It's a diagram of a specific whale taken in the 1830s. By a New Bedford vessel. But part of what's cool about it is that this lance, which is labeled number 11, in the key, it says this is actually a pointer pointing to what the seamen call the life of the whale, namely the point on the body that they tried to hit in order to kill it. And this is a little window into the very interesting vernacular lay ideas about physiology that these guys had. And part of what I can show is that they had a very sophisticated account of the lifeways, behavior, and physiology of the animals, not to mention their anatomy. You see these lines that are traced are the rudimentary traces of what's called a cutting-in diagram, which was the, there's another example, slightly more formalized, a few years later. These were the cutting keys for how you butcher one of these animals. Recent readers of Moby Dick will remember that there's quite a detailed account in Moby Dick of the cutting in of a large whale, which turns out to be surgery on a massive scale, right? You're rotating this animal in the water as two guys are making cuts along these lines. You're using big winches to peel the blubber off the outer layer in order to melt it down. And the dissection of the head to get at the head matter in the spermaceti whale is an additional complicated matter. These were even taught, I love this. This is a model used for teaching seamen on vessels. It's in the collection of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And as you can see, it's carved in wood. It's held together by wire. And you could kind of unroll it like an orange to show somebody how it was they were supposed to do the work of cutting into the animal. So I was able to kind of recover a good deal of the vernacular ideas about natural history that these folks had. They made their own diagrams in the backs of their journals of the different kinds of whales, very much like those that they had seen in some cases in popular natural history books, although with the whaleman's idiosyncratic preference for showing each of the animals spouting blood, which is what they did right before you killed them, right? You stabbed them and then they... that wasn't generally in the popular natural history books, but that's how the whalemen like to see their whales. One of the funniest things I figured out in this work is that, in fact, whalers didn't even call all whales whales. They only really reserved the term whale for spermaceti and right whales, which are the ones you could turn into money. And they called other whales sort of scruffy, diminutive titles like scrag, that's a scrag, or that's a sulfur bottom, or that's a finner, by which, and then they would be like, all these scrags and sulfur bottoms, how about some whales? But of course, like a sulfur bottom is what we call a blue whale. I mean, to us, that's like the biggest and most fantastic whale there is, but it was a whale that they couldn't kill because they were too big and they were too fast, and so they basically didn't register as whales at all in the like sense that you mean when you go out whaling, right? When you're going to go whaling, you got to have a whale you can catch, so everything else is just kind of garbage. I want to keep the pace up, so I'm going to hustle through this part, but in some ways, this is the part that may be of greatest interest. In this section, I open up another community of lay expertise, that of the businessmen who were involved in this kind of dispute. And what I show here is that in the end, this wasn't really just a little commercial transaction gone awry, okay? Why do you have the most expensive lawyers in the city contesting some idiotic minor commercial transaction over $75, which, you know, was like a certain amount of money back then, but not a lot of money, really. It was like, you know, a couple of, like a bushel of good tobacco or something like that. I mean, the legal fees in this case wildly exceeded the sums of money at stake. So, in fact, what this was really a formal test case in which two very powerful communities in New York City of commercial elites were knocking heads. And those two communities were the tanners, increasingly powerful in the city, led by Gideon Lee, who would soon be mayor and was an important figure in this area. And as many of you probably know, tanning was an industry that was increasingly pushing the tendrils of New York City up into this region, into the Adirondacks and so forth, whence came the barks that were used for the tans. The tanners, who made leather on the one hand, and the chandlers and merchants on the other. Because in fact, that whale oil, that fish oil inspection statute had been written by Gideon Lee personally, seen it through the legislature, as part of a very ambitious effort to vertically integrate the tanning industry. He had recently overhauled the Articles of Incorporation in the state of New York to permit him to create a new massive tannery of a scale heretofore unimagined, the New York Tannery in 1818. And he had decided that he was sick of getting crap merchandise from the merchants. And it turns out that fish oil, and to some extent whale oil, is a major ingredient of tanning. After you tan, you have to steep the dry skins in oil to moisturize them again. So a guy like Gideon Lee had stakes in hundreds and hundreds of barrels of whale and fish oil at any given time, and he was bloody tired of being sold oil that had water in it and rocks and all kinds of garbage by these merchants, many of whom hailed from the Massachusetts region and were pushing him the crap junk. And so he had decided to create this system of inspection to crack down on these bastards who kept making his job so difficult. And so when this sort of taxonomic question of whales and fish was introduced, Gideon Lee himself took the stand and were pretty peeved. So here's an oil merchant defending himself. Look, he says, the distinction between meal and flour is not more known than that between whale and fish oil. So this is somebody who's on Judd's side, right? He's saying, I shouldn't have to pay to have whale oil inspected. Or between wheat and buckwheat. If anyone were to order fish oil from me and I were to answer by sending him whale oil, it would be the same as if he'd ordered sugar and I'd sent molasses. These guys came up and they said, look, they have different prices. There are different processes for their production. Fish oil is leached, whale oil is boiled, blah, blah, blah. Price, that's simple. I'd turn down a sale because I wouldn't give the one for the other. For a merchant, nothing speaks more clearly than that, right? I mean, they got to be different. And some of these guys said, look, whales and fish, I don't even care. If you tell me they're fish or not, it doesn't matter. Whale oil and fish oil are different products. Therefore, this statute is wrongly applied in this situation. In the teeth of all of that, the tanner king, Gideon Lee, says, look, we use the general term fish to comprehend all this stuff. I mean we. Plain men who carry on the substantial business of this great world. And however naturalists have made other distinctions and classifications for other purposes, we disregard them. In the course of our common pursuits, we call all marine animals fish and all land animals quadrupeds. And he then lays on the table a packet of all of his bills, kind of his global commerce. You have to kind of imagine Gideon Lee like a hedge fund manager, sort of being like, oh, you're a professor of biology. That's so interesting. I don't care about that. So the answer is that at the core, this trial turns out to be about power politics in New York in a very, very serious way. What I'll do very, very quickly is just touch on the arguments that I'm going to make, and then I'll tell you how it all plays out. So why? You know, the so what question. A couple of things. A history of science point, a kind of an intellectual history point, and a New York history point. A history of science point. Very interesting to understand the relationship between science and the law. That's a general issue that's at stake in this case, about which a lot more can be said. We just did a special issue of the History of Science Journal on science at the bar that gets into these questions. It's a wonderful way to open up complicated issues in the sciences, to see them get contested in legal settings. There's a natural history point, which is a kind of a technical point, again, about the extent to which scholars in history of science have overlooked how much uncertainty there was about natural order in this period. The traditional story is this was the taxonomic calm before the Darwinian storm. First you get Linnaeus, he puts everything in little boxes, everybody's very happy with that. Darwin comes along and he's like, hey, you know what, this isn't a static system, it's dynamic, it's changing, it's evolving. In fact, what I'm trying to show is that there was a lot more uncertainty about the ostensible categories that everyone was so happy with in the period before Darwin. And we see that very clearly here, and it's evidence that it depends on where you look. The naturalists may have all been agreeing with each other a good deal, but if you go one notch below that and you look a little wider, there's a lot of ambivalence toward these new categories. But then there are some kind of bigger intellectual history, American history type points that are at stake. On the one hand, there's a point that, and these points really hinge on the resolution of the case to some significant extent, so let me give you how it ends. What happens? Jury gets the case. Jury takes exactly 10 minutes to decide this case, and they return a verdict that says, look, in New York, a whale's a fish. It just couldn't be simpler. In other words, they fine for Maurice, and Judd has to pay up. He has to pay for the inspection and the fines on his three barrels. So on the one hand, you say a victory for Philistinism or something like that. And certainly some people did say that in the press. But in fact, it's a little more complicated than that, because no sooner had the verdict been decided than there was an appeal, and the back seat juggling was undertaken by the merchants' clan, and they actually were successful in changing the law, and so they succeeded in changing the law. By that time, the appeal came back up. Judge looked at the case again, and he said, well, they had to change the law so in order explicitly to take whales out, and then using a little perverse legal logic, he said, well, that obviously a whale was a fish under the previous law, so you do have to pay the fine, but the good news is you'll never have to pay it again, because heretofore, the law is transformed. What was decisive for the jury? And here's where it gets juicy for New York historians. The very end of the trial, William Sampson, the lawyer for Maurice, has a brilliant idea. He's like, you know what? I just noticed that everybody who's come up here and testified that a whale is not a fish is not originally from New York. Who were they? Well, they were all merchants, right? Or associated with the merchants' faction. And who were the merchants in New York City at that time, in the beginning of the 19th century? They were, very substantially, Yankees. Now, we think of Yankees as like, you know, New York, right? But, of course, in this crowd, I don't need to tell you that New York was Knickerbockers, and Yankees were folks from down east, you know, they were from Massachusetts, and they were not entirely liked in certain ways, right? Tight-fisted, hard-driving, not given to having a good time in certain ways, a good deal of animosity between the traditional Knickerbockers and these ingenue, nouveau types who were making a lot of money pushing around the chandling business and the merchant business. And so what does Sampson do but recall all of the witnesses to the stand and just say, oh, I just had one last question for you. Where are you from anyway? Oh, I see, you're from Massachusetts. And how long have you been in New York? Oh, just 5 or 6 years? Tell me, in Massachusetts, I take it, they really do. They're very keen on this distinction between whales and fish, aren't they, in Massachusetts? Oh, right. So it's more a kind of Massachusetts thing, isn't it, really? The whale-fish distinction? Just checking. Next witness. And he went through everybody. And by the end, he'd effectively sold the jury on the idea that this non-fish whale was a kind of Yankee, what do you want to call it, a kind of an insidious Yankee conspiracy plot to take it to the Knickerbockers. And so there are some wonderful moments where, you know, Samson will say, well, look, we like Yankees. They're very industrious, how shall I put it? But we're not going to let them dictate to us the meanings of good, plain English words that we've been using for a long time. Now, are we members of the jury? To summarize then the larger kind of history points that can come out of this, A, historians have made a lot of the extent to which natural history has played a role in the kind of codification of the American nation, and they have emphasized the extent to which natural history could be used for integrative purposes in a nation that at times seemed to be fissiparous, broken up into parts. I want to suggest, as this case shows, that natural history was a pretty ambivalent way to try to articulate unity, because it could just as easily be used to articulate sectarian division, as indeed it is, quite plainly in this case, by the end. And then the New York history point, this is kind of the beginning of the end for a certain vision of science and society in New York City. That New York institution building that I showed you at the beginning, which was kind of this DeWitt Clinton vision of having a royal society next to his Athenaeum of a fantastic new city hall, that was not going to fly. And instead, it was going to be folks like Gideon Lee and the mechanics guilds who were going to displace this kind of elite culture preoccupation with expertise. A kind of democratic vision of expertise was going to displace an elite culture vision of expertise. And I'll leave you with some a couple of funny quotes that show how real this is. This is some scurrilous stuff written after the trial, making fun of Mitchell and how he had been sent packing back across the park there. Moreover, there's no reason why judges and lawyers, legislators and politicians, office hunters, lobby members, this is making fun of DeWitt Clinton and the Erie Canal, which had just been moved through, may not, before many years in their conveyance upon terms, enjoy the advantages of moving upon a whale's back, infinitely surpassing the speed of a steamboat with which Mitchell was associated, and the shores of the Wallabout may resound with the music which calls the dolphins to be milked, and be studded with villas where the citizens shall repair to enjoy country air and dolphins' way. The Bay of Gowanus, not any longer fit for habitation of anything, the Bay of Gowanus seems designed by nature for the reception of whales, and from them will be derived a rich supply of butter and cheese for home consumption and foreign commerce. So as you can see from this, science took a good knocking on the nose over the course of Maurice V. Judd, and there would be a lot less traffic across the park there between the New York Institution and City Hall in the years to come. Thank you very much for your patience. I appreciate it.